Chapter 6. Prison Animals. Kneedke, a bay horse, was bought a little while afterwards, and the event furnished the convicts with a much more agreeable and interesting diversion than the visit of the high personage of whom I have been speaking. We required a horse for carrying water, refuse, etc. He was put in the charge of a prisoner, who drove him, of course, under escort. Our horse had plenty to do all day. He was a worthy beast, but almost worn out, having been in service for a long time. One fine morning, the eve of St. Peter's Day, our bay, Kneedke, who was dragging a barrel of water, fell all of a heap, and in a few minutes gave up the ghost. He was much regretted, and everyone gathered round to discuss his death. Ex-cavalrymen, gypsies, veterinary surgeons, and others showed a profound knowledge of horses in general, and fiercely argued the question, but they could not bring the bay to life again. There he was, stretched out and dead, with his belly all swollen. Everyone thought it was his duty to handle the poor corpse. The governor was ultimately informed of what Providence had done to the horse, and it was decided that another should be bought at once. On St. Peter's Day, quite soon after Mass, when the convicts were assembled, a number of horses that were for sale were brought in. It was left to the prisoners to choose an animal, for there were some thorough experts among them, and it would have been difficult to deceive 250 men who had been horse dealers by trade. Gypsies, Lesgians, professional horse copers, and townsmen arrived to bargain. The convicts showed extraordinary keenness as each fresh horse was brought up, and were as delighted as children. It seemed to tickle their fancy very much that they had to buy a horse like freemen, just as if the animal were to be their own property, and the money was to come out of their own pockets. Three horses were brought and taken away before purchase. The fourth proved satisfactory. The dealers seemed astonished and a little awed by the soldiers of the escort who watched the business. 200 men, clean-shaven and branded as they were, with chains on their feet, were well calculated to inspire respect, all the more as they were on their own ground, at home, so to speak, in their own convict's den, where nobody was ever allowed to come. Our fellows seemed up to no end of tricks for discovering the real worth of a horse. They examined it carefully, handled it gravely, and behaved as if the welfare of the establishment depended upon the purchase of this beast. The Circassians took the liberty of jumping upon his back. Their eyes shone wildly. They chatted rapidly in their incomprehensible dialect, showing their white teeth, dilating the nostrils of their hooked, copper-coloured noses. There were some Russians who paid the most lively attention to their discussion, and seemed ready to jump down their throats. They did not understand a word, but it was plain that they were doing their best to read from the fellow's eyes whether or not the horse was good. But what could it matter to a convict, especially to some of them, who were utterly abandoned creatures, and who never ventured to utter a single word to others? What could it matter to such as these whether one horse or another was bought? Yet it seemed to do so. The opinion of the Circassians appeared to be principally relied upon, and next to them those gypsies, who had formerly been horse-dealers, were most prominently in the debate. There was a regular duel between two convicts, the gypsy Kulikov, who had been a horse-dealer and thief, and Zhulkin, who had been a professional veterinary surgeon, a tricky Siberian peasant who had been doing hard labour for some considerable time, and who had succeeded in getting all Kulikov's practice in the town. I should mention that our veterinary surgeons, though without diploma, were very much sought after, and that not only the townsfolk and tradesmen, but also high officials in the city took their advice when their horses fell ill, rather than that of several properly qualified practitioners whose services were available. Before Zhulkin came, the Siberian peasant Kulikov had had numerous clients from whom he had taken fees in good hard cash. Looked upon as being the head of his profession, he was a typical gypsy, a liar, a cheat, and by no means the master of his art he claimed to be. His earnings had raised him to almost aristocratic rank among the prisoners, He was listened to and obeyed, but he spoke little and expressed his opinion only in great emergencies. He blew his own trumpet loudly. But he was really a most energetic fellow, of ripe age and marked intelligence. When he spoke of the aristocracy, it was with exquisite politeness and perfect dignity. I am sure that if he had been suitably dressed and introduced as a count to a Petersburg club, he would have lived up to the part, played whist, talked to admiration like a man used to command, but who knew when to hold his tongue. I am sure that a whole evening might have passed without anyone guessing that the count was nothing but a vagabond. He had very probably had a large and varied experience of life, but we knew nothing about his past. He lived apart, segregated with the special section. No sooner had Jolkin arrived. He was a simple peasant, one of the old believers, but just as cunning as it was possible for a mujik to be, than Kulikov's veterinary glory sensibly declined. In less than 2 months the Siberian had won all his practice in town, for he cured in a very short time horses which Kulikov had declared incurable, and which had been given up by the regular practitioners. Jolkin had been condemned to hard labour for coining. It is odd that he should ever have ventured into that line of business. He told us all about it, and joked about the fact that 3 genuine gold coins were required to make 1 false one. Kulikov was not a little annoyed by this peasant's success, while his own glory so rapidly declined. There was he who had had a mistress in the suburbs, who used to wear a plush jacket and top boots, and was now obliged to turn tavern keeper, so everyone expected a regular row when the new horse was bought. It was most interesting. Each had his partisans, and the more zealous among them came to angry words without delay. Jolkin's cunning face was wrinkled into a sarcastic smile, but things turned out quite differently from what was anticipated. Kulikov had not the least desire for argument or dispute. He managed cunningly without that. At first he gave way on every point and listened deferentially to his rival's criticisms. Then he took him up sharply on some chance remark, and pointed out to him modestly but firmly that he was all wrong. In a word, Jolkin was utterly discomfited in a surprisingly clever way, at which Kulikov's party was delighted.
"I say, boys, it's no use talking. You can't trip him up. He knows what he's about," said one.
"Jolkin knows more about the matter than he does," said others, but without offence. Both sides were prepared to make concessions.
"Then he's got a lighter hand, besides having more in his head. I tell you, when it comes to stock, horses, or anything else, Kulikov needn't duck under to anybody."
"Nor need Jolkin, I tell you. There's nobody like Kulikov."
The new horse was selected and bought. It was a capital gelding, young, vigorous, and handsome, an absolutely irreproachable beast. When the bargaining began, the owner asked 30 roubles. The convicts would not give more than 25. The haggling continued for long and with much heat. At length the convicts began to laugh.
"Does the money come out of your own purse?" said one. "What's the good of all this?"
"Do you want to help the treasury?" cried others.
"But it's money that belongs to all of us, pals," said one.
"All of us! It's plain enough that you needn't trouble to cultivate idiots. They'll grow of themselves without that."
At last the business was settled at 28 roubles. The governor was informed and the purchase sanctioned. Bread and salt were brought at once, and the new boarder led in triumph to the jail. There was not one convict, I think, who did not pat his neck or stroke his head. He was set the same day to carting water. All the convicts watched with curiosity as he pulled at the barrel. Our waterman, a convict named Roman, kept his eyes on the beast with a kind of stupid satisfaction. Formerly a peasant, he was about 50 years of age, serious and silent, like all Russian coachmen, whose grave demeanour appears to be enhanced by their constant companionship of horses. Roman was a quiet creature, affable to all. He said little and took snuff from a box. He had tended the prison horse for some considerable time. The new acquisition was the third entrusted to his care since his arrival. The horseman's job fell as a matter of course to Roman. Nobody would have dreamed of contesting his right to it. When the bay horse dropped dead, no one, not even the governor, thought of accusing Roman of carelessness. It was the will of God, that was all. As for Roman, well, he knew his business. The bay horse became at once the prison pet. The convicts were not particularly tender-hearted, but they could not help frequently going up to stroke him. Sometimes, when Roman returned from the river and shut the great gate which a junior officer had opened, Gniedke would stand quite still, waiting for his driver, and turning to him as if for orders. "Get along, you know the way," Roman would cry. Then Gniedke would go off peaceably to the kitchen and wait while the cooks and other servants filled their buckets with water, which Gniedke seemed to expect.
"Gniedke, you're a trump! Why, he's brought his water barrel himself! He's a delight to see!" they would cry.
"That's true. He's only an animal, but he understands everything that's said to him. No end of a horse, our Gniedke!"
At which the horse would shake his head and snort, just as if he really understood that he was being praised. Then someone would bring him bread and salt. When he had finished, he would once more shake his head, as if to say, "I know you, I know you. I'm a good horse, and you're a good fellow." I quite enjoyed regaling Gniedke with bread. It was a pleasure to look at his handsome mouth and to feel his warm, moist lips licking up the crumbs from the palm of my hand. The convicts were fond of living things, and, if they had been allowed, would have filled the barracks with birds and domestic animals. What could have been better calculated to soften and ennoble their fierce tempers than to look after such creatures? But it was not permitted. It was not in the regulations, and indeed there was no room for many animals. However, during my time there, a number of animals had established themselves in the jail. Besides Gniedke, we had some dogs, geese, a billy-goat called Vaska, and an eagle, which latter remained for only a short time. I believe I have already mentioned that our dog was known as Bull, and that he and I had struck up a friendship. But as the lower classes regard dogs as impure beasts unworthy of attention, nobody cared for him. He lived in the jail itself, slept in the courtyard, ate the leavings of the kitchen, and had no hold whatever on the prisoners' sympathy. He knew them all, however, and regarded them as his masters and owners. When the men returned from work, he would hear their cry, "Corporal!" come running to the great gate, and gaily welcome the gang, wagging his tail and looking into each man's eyes as though he expected a caress. But for several years his little efforts were as useless as they were engaging. Nobody but myself caressed him, so that he preferred me to all others. By some means, of which I am uncertain, we got another dog. He was called Snow. Finally there was a third, named Kultiapka, whom I myself brought into prison when he was only a puppy. Snow was an odd creature. A telega had gone over him and crushed his spine, making it curve, which, when you saw him running at a distance, made him look like twin dogs born with a ligament. He was very mangy, too, with bleary eyes. His tail was hairless and always hung between his legs. A victim of ill fate, he seemed to have made up his mind to remain always quite impassive. He never barked at anyone, seeming to be afraid of getting into fresh trouble. He was nearly always lurking at the back of the buildings, and if anybody approached, he would immediately roll on his back, as though he meant to say, "Do what you like with me. I've not the least idea of resisting." As the dog lay there with his legs in the air, every prisoner felt obliged to give him a passing kick. "Ah, the dirty brute," they would say. But Snow dared not so much as utter a groan. If he were very much hurt, he would only utter a little dull, strangled yelp.
He threw himself down in just the same way before Bull or any other member of the species when he went to try his luck at the kitchen, and he would stretch himself out flat if a mastiff or other large dog came barking at him. Dogs like submission and humility in other dogs, so the angry brute immediately quietened down and stopped short reflectively before the poor humble beast, and then sniffed him curiously all over. I wonder what poor Snow was thinking of at such moments, as he trembled with fright. Is this brigand going to bite me? Something of the kind, no doubt. Having sniffed his fill without discovering anything of interest, the big brute would wander off. Snow used then to jump to his feet and join a crowd of his own tribe, chasing some Yutchka. Snow knew full well that no Yutchka would ever condescend to such as he, that she was too proud for that, but it was some consolation to him in his troubles to be able to limp after her. He had but the vaguest notion of anything like decent behaviour. Being devoid of hope for his future, his highest aim was to get a bellyful of victuals, and he was cynical enough in making that fact known. I once tried to caress him. This was the very last thing that he expected. He dropped on the ground quite helpless, quivering and whimpering with delight. As I was really sorry for him, I used often to caress him, and as soon as he caught sight of me, he began to whine in a plaintive, tearful way. He met his end in a ditch at the back of the jail. Some dogs tore him to pieces. Kultiapka was quite a different type of dog. I don't know why I brought him in from one of the workshops where he had just been born, but it gave me pleasure to feed him and watch him grow. Bull took Kultiapka under his protection and slept with him. When the puppy began to grow up, Bull was remarkably patient with him, allowing him to bite his ears and take his skin in his teeth. He played with him as mature dogs generally do with youngsters. It was a strange thing, but Kultiapka never grew in height, but only in length and breadth. His hide was fluffy and mouse-coloured. One of his ears hung down, while the other was always cocked up. He was, like all young dogs, ardent and enthusiastic, yelping with pleasure when he saw his master, and jumping up to lick his face, precisely as if trying to say, "As long as he sees how delighted I am, I don't care. Let etiquette go to the devil." Wherever I was, I had only to call Kultiapka for him to leave his corner and come towards me with noisy satisfaction, curling up into a ball and rolling over and over. I was exceedingly fond of the little wretch, and I used to fancy that destiny had reserved for him only joy and pleasure in this world of ours. But one fine day, a prisoner named Neustroyev, who made women's shoes and prepared skins, cast his eye on him. Something had evidently occurred to him, for he called Kultiapka, felt his skin, and turned him over on the ground in a friendly way. The unsuspicious dog barked with pleasure, but next day he was nowhere to be found. I hunted for him for some time, but in vain. At last, after 2 weeks, all was explained. Kultiapka's natural cloak had been too much for Neustroyev, who had flayed him and used his skin to make some boots of fur-lined velvet ordered by the young wife of an official. He showed them to me when they were finished. The inside lining was magnificent. All Kultiapka. Poor fellow. A good many convicts worked at tanning, and often brought in dogs with a nice skin. These animals had been bought or stolen, and thus quickly vanished. I remember one day seeing a couple of prisoners behind the kitchens laying their heads together. One of them held on a leash a very fine black dog of particularly good breed. A rascally footman had stolen it from his master and sold it to our shoemakers for 30 kopecks. They were going to hang it. That was their way of disposing of dogs. Then they would remove the skin and throw the body into a rubbish dump at the farthest corner of the courtyard, which stank most horribly during the summer heat, for it was rarely attended to. I think the poor beast understood the fate in store for him. He looked at us, one after another, with curiosity and obvious distress. At intervals,
He gave a timid little wag with his bushy tail that lay between his legs, as though trying to reach our hearts by a show of confidence. I hurried away and left the others to finish their vile work. As to the prison geese, they had established themselves quite by chance. Who took care of them? To whom did they belong? I really don't know. But they were a huge delight to the convicts, and acquired a certain fame throughout the town. They had been hatched somewhere in the jail, and their headquarters was the kitchen, whence they used to emerge in gaggles when the men went out to work. But as soon as the drum beat and the prisoners assembled at the great gate, out ran the geese after them, cackling, flapping their wings, and finally jumping over one another, over the raised threshold of the gateway. While the convicts were at work, the geese pecked about at a little distance from them. As soon as they had done and set out for the jail, the geese rejoined the procession, and the passers-by would cry out, "I say, look! There are the prisoners with their friends the geese. How did you teach them to follow you?" someone would ask. "Here's some money for your geese," another might say, putting his hand in his pocket. In spite of their devotion to the convicts, however, they had their necks twisted one year to make a feast at the end of Lent. Nobody would ever have decided to kill our goat Vaska had not something extraordinary happened. I don't know how it came to be in the prison, or who had brought it. It was a white kid and very pretty. After some days, it had won all hearts with its diverting and winning ways. As some excuse was needed for keeping it in the jail, it was given out that it was absolutely necessary to have a goat in the stables. Vaska did not, however, live there, but chiefly in the kitchen, and after a while he used to roam about all over the place. The creature was full of grace and playful as could be. He jumped on the tables, wrestled with the convicts, came when called, and was always full of fun and high spirits. One evening, the lesbian Babai, who was seated with a crowd of fellows on the stone steps at the door of the barrack, took it into his head to have a wrestling bout with Vaska, whose horns were fairly long. They were butting one another with their foreheads, a procedure whereby the men used often to amuse themselves, when all of a sudden Vaska jumped on the highest step, reared on his hind legs, drew up his forefeet, and managed to strike the lesbian on the back of the neck with all his might, and with such effect that Babai went headlong down the steps, to the great delight of all the bystanders, as well as of Babai himself. Yes, we all adored our Vaska. When he reached the age of puberty, a solemn conclave was held, as a result of which he was subjected to an operation performed with great skill by one of the prison vets. "Well," said the convicts, "he won't have any goat smell about him. That's one comfort." Vaska then began to put on fat in the most surprising manner, though I must confess that we overfed him. He became a most beautiful fellow, with magnificent horns and corpulent beyond words. Sometimes, as he walked, he rolled over heavily on the ground through sheer obesity. He used to accompany us to work, which amused the convicts and everyone else who watched. There was nobody who was unacquainted with Vaska the jailbird. Whilst at work on the river bank, the prisoners used to cut willow branches and other foliage, and gather flowers in the ditches to ornament Vaska. They used to twine the branches and flowers round his horns and decorate his body with garlands. Vaska would return at the head of the gang, splendidly arrayed. We followed, full of pride at seeing him so beautiful. Love for our goat went so far that prisoners raised the foolish question whether Vaska ought not to have his horns gilded. It was a vain idea, and nothing came of it. I asked Akim Akimich, the best gilder in the jail, whether it were possible to gild a goat's horns. He examined Vaska's closely, thought a bit, and then said that it could be done, but that it would not last, and would be quite useless, so nothing more was done. Vaska would have lived for many years more, and, no doubt, have died of asthma at the last, if one day, as he returned from work at the head of the procession, His path had not been crossed by the governor, who was seated in his carriage. Vasco was in particularly gorgeous array.
"Halt!" yelled the governor. "Whose goat is that?"
They told him.
"What? A goat in the prison? And without my leave? Sergeant!"
The sergeant was ordered to kill the goat without a moment's delay, flay him and sell his skin, and put the proceeds to the prisoner's account. As to the meat, he ordered it to be cooked with the cabbage soup. The occurrence was much discussed, and the goat was much mourned, but nobody dared disobey the governor. Vasco was put to death close to the rubbish dump to which I have alluded. One of the convicts brought the carcass, paying a ruble and 50 kopecks, and with this money white bread was bought for everybody. The man who had purchased the goat afterwards sold it at retail when it had been roasted. The meat was delicious. We also kept, for some time, a steppe eagle, quite a small species. A convict brought it in, wounded and half dead. Everyone gathered round. The bird could not fly, its right wing being quite powerless, and one of its legs was badly hurt. It gazed angrily upon the curious crowd, and opened its crooked beak, as if prepared to sell its life dearly. After watching it for some time, the crowd dispersed. The lamed bird went off, hopping on one leg and flapping his wing, hid itself in the farthest corner of the prison which it could find, and there cowered against the palings. During the 3 months that he remained in the courtyard, he never left that corner. At first we went to look at him fairly often. Bull was sometimes set at him. Furiously he would rush, but was frightened to go too near, which greatly amused the convicts.
"A wild chap, that. He won't stand any nonsense."
But after a while, Bull overcame his fear and began to worry the eagle. When roused, the dog would catch hold of his broken wing. The creature would defend itself with beak and claws, and then huddle even closer in its corner, with the proud, savage look of a wounded king, fixing his gaze steadily upon those who beheld his misery. The men tired of this sport after a while, and the eagle seemed quite forgotten. But there was someone who every day set by him a fresh piece of meat and a vessel with some water. At first, and for several days, the eagle would touch nothing, but at last he decided to take what was left for him, though he would never be persuaded to take anything from the hand or in public. Sometimes I managed to observe his proceedings from some distance. When he saw nobody and thought he was alone, he ventured out of his corner, limped along the palisade for a dozen yards or so, and then returned. So he would go, backward and forward, as if he were taking exercise for his health under doctor's orders. As soon as he caught sight of me, he would make for his corner as quickly as possible, limping and hopping. He would then throw back his head, open his mouth, ruffle himself, and apparently prepare to fight. In vain I tried to caress him. He bit and struggled as soon as he was touched. Not once did he take the meat I offered him, and all the time I remained near him, he kept his wicked, piercing eye upon me. Lonely and revengeful, he waited for death, defiant and refusing to be reconciled. At last, after 2 months of oblivion, the convicts remembered him. Then they showed a sympathy which I had not expected of them. It was unanimously agreed to carry him outside.
"Let him die, but let him die in freedom," said they. "Sure enough, a free and independent bird like that will never get used to the prison," added others. "He's not like us," said one. "Oh, well, he's a bird and we're human beings." "The eagle, pals, is the king of the woods," began Skuratov, but that day nobody paid any attention to him.
One afternoon, when the drum beat for work, they took the eagle, tied his beak, for he assumed a desperate attitude, and took him out onto the ramparts. The 12 convicts forming the gang were extremely anxious to know where he would go. It was a strange thing. They all seemed as happy as though they had themselves obtained their freedom.
"Oh, the wretched brute!"
"'One wants to do him a kindness, and he tears your hand for you by way of thanks,' said the man who held him, looking almost lovingly at the spiteful bird.
"'Let him go, Mikitka. It doesn't suit him being a prisoner. Give him his freedom, his jolly freedom.'
They threw him from the ramparts onto the steppe. It was the end of autumn, a grey, cold day. The wind whistled on the bare steppe and went groaning through the yellow, dried-up grass. The eagle made off at once, flapping his wounded wing, as if in a hurry to quit us and find shelter from our inquisitive gaze. The convicts watched him intently as he went along, with his head just above the grass.
"'Do you see him, eh?' said one, very pensively. "'He doesn't look round,' said another. "'He hasn't looked behind once.'
"'Did you by any chance imagine he'd come back to thank us?' said a third.
"'Aye, he's free. He feels it. It's freedom.'
"'Yes, freedom.
You won't see him any more, pals.
"'What are you loitering about for? March! March!' yelled the escort, and all went slowly to their work.'